Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello you, and welcome to the very first episode of The High Low. Bloody hell, it's good to be here finally. Land sakes a goshen, we're excited to bring this to you. Yes, as Dolly says, holy crap, it's been a lot of work. For those of you that assume we have been fiddling with our nail fungus.
Thank you for all those emails, by the way, we loved those.
Telling us we were being really idle. rather than creating a brand new podcast, we will have you know that we have been brainstorming our new name. We've gone through some very interesting ones en route to...
Yes, I can't remember most of them, but there was some Zeitgeist and Dolls made an appearance again. That was back on the list.
Just obsessed
there was a lot
with
of blondes on blonde. Blonde babes, blonde fun. It kind of sounded
porny.
Babe Station, also a bit like an 80s pop duo. So we abandoned those.
So we've been creating a new podcast with a new name, some zhuzhi new artwork with the help of Eva Salvi, Natalia Bagneshka, and Fash Gif. We have commissioned a jazzy jingle from the super talented Lauren Benstead.
And it is jazzy.
It is jazzy.
Everyone would agree it is jazzy.
It's very high low. And we've hooked up with a super cool new producer, Charlie. We miss you, Dave, and we hope travelling the world with your fiance is super fun, but we're devoted to Charlie now. And we've also been finding our new studio home at SNK Studios in Tottenham Court Road, and they give us like water and lollies.
I know.
I'm going to unwrap it at some point, and I'll try and do it really surreptitiously, and Dolly will go, are you unwrapping your lolly?
It's like business class. I'd also like to mention a shout out to Dave, that there was a moment where we were so attached to him we sort of suggested that he didn't take this trip so he could continue being our producer. But anyway, hope you're having a good time, Dave. As you may have gathered, the Pandolly podcast is no more. R.I.P. Pandolly, fun while it lasted. The High Low is our new independent project, a bit like Pandora.
Yes, I have now left the Sunday Times, which was a sad but also exciting decision. So like a brand new podcast, I am a new independent woman, and I've had a really interesting month adjusting to freelance life. Dolly got a bit worried when I kept sending her pictures of me in tracksuits, but I snapped out of it. I'm back to normality.
Yeah, the tracksuit days are over. It was when you teamed them with the bloody Crocs when I really started worrying. So Pandora is now an independent woman. My Sunday Times style dating column is no more, so it has been an adventurous time for us both, particularly for me. I'm now going on dates and I don't have to write about them, which is
quite,
quite
weird?
Thing.
Yeah, you're thinking, what's my story? What's my story?
Completely. I went on a date last week with a guy and it was perfectly nice and relaxed. And halfway through, I went to the loo and I was like, so used to, I was like, oh my God, I don't have to make this like
copy,
Miranda Hart like slapstick caper, or I don't have to like make him my husband tomorrow. This can just be a nice date. So yes, that's taking some adjusting too. But new horizons for both of us.
New horizons, and together we will be bringing you our weekly news and pop culture podcast, The High Low.
The High Low. So we aim to bring it to you by 8 a.m. every Wednesday, but please be aware that sometimes it may be other days as we're juggling kind of other projects and obligations. And also, you know, I've had a fringe cut since we last recorded, and that's taking up so much of my time managing that. And also occasionally, very, very occasionally, we might have a week off.
Yes, perish the thought of a week off, she says, as she boards a plane to Jamaica for a wedding. As you listen to this, I will be en route to the airport. But yeah, the High Low, back to the High Low, not my holiday. The High Low is based on the founding message that life is best consumed with a mix of the trivial and the political, the errant chin hair to the Trumpian politics, if you will.
Or as I like to say, looking at stories far and wide from brows high and low. I was talking to my mum about the High Low and she said, so whatever the height of your brow, there's something for everyone. And I was like, yes, mum, you should have worked in advertising.
Some people actually thought it was based on Dolly being high, i.e. tall, and me being low, i.e. small.
And also because I'm always smoking the ganja and you're always depressed.
And I had to remind people that, no, Dolly is not one and I am not the other. Although, if you look at our artwork, I am cradling the low. The high-low is based on the Vanity Fair editor of the 80s, Tina Brown, a very inspirational woman who coined the term high-low media. And it just really encompasses how Dolly and I live our lives and use our brains. You shouldn't be ashamed of deep liking Kylie Jenner on Instagram. That sounds like something else.
Yeah, that's an interesting
one. Yeah, it's an interesting one, deep liking.
Compound verb there.
In the same way that finishing a particularly turgid piece of prose should not make you feel superior. So tonally, we're all on the level.
For those of you who were fond, attached to the Pandolly format, the format to the high-low will be similar. There'll be obviously some tweaks here and there, but please do spare us your tweets if we preferred your early albums. Things have got to change. We all move on. But it will generally kind of feel like it's the same shape.
Yeah. You can get in touch with the high-low at the high-low show on Twitter. I was really overexcitedly retweeting everyone's messages to us when
it was a touch basic.
I said to Dolly, is it too much? And she was like, no, darling, I think it's fine now, but
it's
when we launch, you might want to ease off. And you can get in touch with us at Gmail, thehighlowshow@gmail.com. Please do ask us any questions and let us know any feedback.
I've really missed doing this podcast with you. There was 10 weeks where I just had no appropriate forum to discuss all the really important things we need to talk about. Like, we haven't talked about the affair.
Oh, my God. Yes, that was... Oof. I'm quite glad we didn't have to talk about the affair.
I know. And also, the potential hardness or softness of Brexit. All this stuff, we haven't had a public
Also sounds
platform.
Quite porny. And drones! Do you remember when I found that? Oh, my God, that's going to be really soaring down someone's ear during their commute. Drones! Remember when I found that £1,300 drone that hovered above your head in case of rain? So you'd be just pootling down the pavement and this little drone would be zzz above your head.
I know.
And then when it rained, an umbrella would shoot out.
And we were so sad. We were so sad. So we were like, if only we could talk about this.
I was really sorrowful. I had nowhere to talk about it.
I mean, we could talk about it. It wouldn't be recorded.
I think I did tweet it and no one replied. Also, I have been longing for today's episode so that I could tell everyone to buy or at least read all the great articles about a new book by Adam Alter called Irresistible, Why We Can't Stop Checking, Scrolling, Clicking and Watching. So it's basically about social media addiction and it sounds absolutely fascinating.
I'm too scared to read
it. So there's some amazing, there's a really brilliant article by Oliver Thring for the Sunday Times Culture magazine that came out on Sunday. And he put all sorts of insight into there. Like China now has, guess how many clinics China has treating internet addiction? You can't see my snippet, so you won't know.
Five.
China's enormous. 400. Has 400 clinics treating internet addiction. And there is also...
That's insane.
There's also a World of Warcraft treatment centre in Oregon for addicts.
Is that a game?
World of Warcraft?
Yeah.
It's got like 100 million subscribers worldwide. Like massive, massive
I've really
game.
Missed this as well. I've really
Biggest
missed my
game.
Ignorance of
World
the zeitgeist
of Warcraft must
being
be going
revealed
on for about
publicly.
10 years. I'm terrified of having a son who wants to play video games for 18 hours a day. That's how long some of these people play World of Warcraft. I think they're so insidious and dangerous. And actually, Oliver Thring wrote in his piece, he flagged up an app called Moment, which tracks how much time a user spends on his or her iPhone.
I need to do that.
Yeah, I think we should download it this
yes,
week.
And then see what we do. Yeah.
And then report back next
week. It's kind of like
week.
My fitness pal.
Well, it will tell you. So it told him that he had checked his phone 80 times that day and that he had spent 2 hours on his
Panda,
phone.
I think mine would be more. I'm really realising how bad it is.
It depends.
At the moment.
If I'm at my computer, I'll be on my phone a lot less because I'm doing my emails and my filing for now.
I'm so addicted, I sometimes will be sitting on Twitter and...
Sitting on it?
I was
I've got an image
Twitter.
Of you just squashing your phone.
I will be sitting on my computer looking at Twitter and I will get my phone out to refresh Twitter. That's how bad I am.
Wait, you're sitting on Twitter on your computer?
Yes, and I'll get my phone to refresh because it's so just like muscle memory. I'm so used to doing it, even though I'm looking at the Twitter homepage. It's really bad. I've realised recently how bad it's got, so maybe I do need to read that.
Yeah, I think you should do. I think you should read the book, and I think you should download.
Get a life.
Moment. And we're also going to do a book recommendation every week. We both read a lot, and that's always proved popular. With people.
Yeah,
to
people
hear
are
what
always
we're up
asking
to.
Our book recommendations.
Yeah, Dol, what's yours this week?
Mine this week is Home Cooking by Laurie Colwin, which is a beautiful series of food essays, and it's just lovely. And there's recipes intersliced? Is that the
interspersed?
Interspersed.
Have
throughout.
You put that on the Dolly Mail before? I recognise this.
No, I Instagrammed it the other day. A passage about potato salad.
Potato salad. Yeah, yes, it's so good.
If you love food, which obviously I do, and you love kind of the machinations and traditions and history,
the storytelling
of it, then you should definitely read it. It's a charming, charming book.
So my book recommendations, I've been reading lots in the past few weeks, but actually I haven't read anything this year that I was completely obsessed with. I did read a book over New Year, and I'm about to start another one by her, by Jamie Attenberg. She is my obsession at the moment. She is a Jewish writer from New York, and I have bought all of her books.
Is this one you told me?
Yeah, I sort of keep telling everyone to read it. And I'm also really enjoying short stories. I was listening to another great podcast called Seriously by the New Statesman.
We love that podcast.
Yeah. Hi, Seriously.
The sisterhood of podcasts.
Yes, the sisterhood of podcasts, the lady podcasters, as I hate to refer to it. But they flagged up some short stories called The Shore. I can't remember who they're by. And then another short story compilation as well. Anyway, short stories in all forms. Well, like the short story form.
Short stories
perhaps by all authors.
In all forms.
So I'm really enjoying the short story. Have I talked about the short story enough?
It's like you've always loved short stories, haven't you?
Yes, I do. They are.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My fave. Masses has been happening this week. Before we get to the inevitable not orgasms, Oscars.
Boring.
God, ever the dating columnist. We're going to talk about Girls because Dolly and I were completely floored by the latest episode in the 6th and final series. That is episode 3. If you are not watching Girls, we implore you to. It's the most brilliant piece of writing.
Just getting better and better.
I don't care if you hated season 1, 2 or 3. I fell by the wayside, I think, in the middle, maybe season 4. But Lena Dunham and her writing in particular have evolved so much. And I really believe that this series is telly history.
I completely agree.
They feel like short films.
I completely agree. Actually, I dipped in series 4 as well, but I was very impressed with series 5. Everything was tied together really artfully. I thought the references went deeper, the subjects went darker, the relationships were more strained and examined, so it's much more psychological. The adults, the parents, they were all the bosses, they were all written.
All fleshed out.
Really fleshed out,
and
really
cameos,
fully and
my
really well.
God, the cameos are just the
cameos
people.
Were great.
And it shows how omnipotent she is now in Hollywood, that you are
she
getting
can pull anyone in.
Massive yeah. people doing cameos.
Yeah. Why would you not? You would be honoured to be asked to be a part of that show. Last series, there was an amazing episode that Pandora and I were both obsessed with called The Panic in Central Park with Alison Williams and...
Oh, the one where she goes back to her... Ex-boyfriend
Charlie.
For an episode. Oh my God.
And it was very dark and it was very sad and it was very powerful. And that was inspired by Joan Didion's film that she made with her husband called The Panic in Needle Park. So it's just all those references.
She's come out. Alison Williams is like, people are really watching her, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
People are watching all of them, to be fair. But I feel like Alison Williams, she's just been really brilliant.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, so I loved last series. I thought the music was used so well and characters were developing properly. The jokes were really funny and I didn't think it'd get any better. I was actually quite nervous about the series because last series was so good. I worried it peaked kind of at the 11th hour. But the series, man, is
the
even...
The series, man.
But it's so good.
So good, man.
So good, man. It's even more sophisticated. It's taking on social commentary, which is just such a brave and useful thing to do. This last episode I watched and then immediately... watched it again and demanded that Pandora...
Twice?
Yeah, I watched Pandora.
Oh, I feel like I'm behind.
Demanded Pandora watch it. So, bottle episode, all happens in one place and one time. It's in real time. It mirrors another brilliant episode from series 2 in which she... Did you watch that one where she met the divorcee and the chance encounter in a coffee
Hannah.
Shop? Yes,
yeah,
and she
yeah.
goes
so
to
Lena
his brownstone.
Yeah.
Yes, Hannah Horvath does. And it becomes a kind of intense two-hander. Many critics, the New Yorker, have said they kind of are like... She writes them like a play, which this episode definitely felt like. So yeah. This episode, Hannah Horvath goes to beautiful
Spoiler
New York...
Spoiler alert, by the way. We are literally going to do a... of the entire entire episode and talk about why we found it really powerful.
So fast forward
if you really don't want us to spoil
but
it.
But most people that I saw on Twitter have watched it and were equally floored by it. Hannah Horvath goes to a beautiful New York apartment to meet a very successful older male writer who has asked her to go to his home. She has written an article for a feminist website about a slew of allegations that have been made against him by female... They're college students, aren't they?
Mm, I think so.
These allegations have been made online about how he forced them into blowjobs.
Yeah. Okay, so spoiler alert. So she enters his she goes into his apartment and she finds this rather...
that's water, by the way. Wine. That's not like the Christmas special when we were roaring through Prosecco.
For those of you that remember that episode. So she finds this rather tragic figure in an amazing loft and she goes, I didn't realise writers made this much money. Which is such a great sort of meta joke because if anyone has watched Lena Dunham's 73 Questions with US Vogue, you'll know that she's making a lot of money. Anyway, he ends up making her feel very bad for judging him on what he says a consensual instance. He says, you know, I'm really horny, sure, and I've got the self-control of a toddler, but I'm fallible. And he's like, oh God, you're actually really funny, you're really special, I picked you to come and talk to me.
It's really creepy that
I picked you to come and talk to me because, you know, you're such an amazing writer. And she's thinking, okay, I got him wrong, you know, he really respects me, he respects my writing. And there's an excellent New Yorker piece that Dolly was talking about which we will tweet after the show that you should read, and they trade books they love. And then he says, I just want to lie down, I'm tired. And by that point, you know, she thinks they're friends. She lies down next to him and it's all very platonic. And she goes, you know, I'm sorry for writing this. You're right. I don't know you. I don't know your story. And he goes, that's okay. And then he whacks his dick onto her thigh.
And it's such a strangely smooth move as well.
It's
so rehearsed.
And your eyes just, you go, I think I did that alone whilst watching it in my room. And you realise in an instant that he wants her to know that she isn't special. Mm. He didn't ask her here because she was special. He asked her here to show how easy it is to make a woman feel like they're special and get her to lie down next to you, and how very, very easy it is to get her to touch the head of your penis. And the episode ends with this stream of glorious women going into the apartment after Hannah, and Hannah just realising with utter shame and total ego shattering, because it is her ego that has led her to this point, that she is just one of them, just another young, talented woman falling for his bullshit. She went in there specifically to call him out on this bullshit, and she fell for it.
And the ending as well is so powerful, because obviously it's kind of surreal and it's like they are metaphorical women. That's how I read it, that are kind of streaming in after her.
Yes, absolutely.
All the future victims that will fall prey to him. It's an extremely confronting, uncomfortable piece of TV. It explores something incredibly complex and important, and something that is very close to Lena Dunham's heart, obviously, as she's written about it and spoken out so eloquently and passionately before, which is the topic of consent and power. And this episode is a conversation about, as the character herself refers to it in the episode, the alleged grey area of consent. She says at some point, I'm so fucking sick of grey areas. And it's about how someone can be coerced, manipulated or abused without being penetratively raped. It's giving a very real voice and showing the flip side of a very old and depressingly familiar story in which a victim is told she or he wanted it or didn't shout stop, or if you didn't want to have sex with him, why did you have a drink with him? All that kind of stuff. That's what it's a response to. It shows another side to that tale, finally. A man in great power who knows his currency over women with low self-esteem, who, thanks to the patriarchal society we live in, has been silenced or made to feel invisible, corners someone and makes them feel special, makes them feel like they exist, as Hannah's character says. And the best part is it's not Hannah Horvath becoming this Jiminy Cricket of the whole thing, lecturing everyone on morality. She herself falls victim to it. You see it in action.
But also I think the really interesting thing is I don't think she's passive in this. I don't think she's a passive victim. I think she's an active victim, if there is such a thing, in that she actively makes these choices whilst analysing everything she's doing,
and she still is manipulated.
And also, I felt complicit as a viewer. I was completely fooled. I believed everything he was saying. I started feeling sorry for him. I was Hannah, except I did not have an actual penis on my thigh. I had a metaphorical one. But that's it. That's why it's so clever, and that's why it's such sophisticated, multi-layered writing, because you watch her get fooled, even as the audience we are fooled. She thinks she has the upper hand, and then you see exactly the same thing happen to her. It's an immersive viewing experience.
That's why it feels quite like a play, because it is very immersive. And the thing is I can't believe this was written 9 months ago. I just think it's so damn clever, because look where we are culturally, politically and societally. Mm. It's so prescient, because we're in a time where...
Spookily so.
Spookily prescient. Trump is basically putting his unwelcome dick on strangers' thighs. President Trump is a dick on a thigh. Thigh dicking is the new pussy grabbing.
Well, as Pandora says, I don't know the exact timeline, but this would have been written way before Pussy Grabbing Gate, or rather as we've newly anointed Thigh Dick Gate, which is all about a man thinking that his status or power or talent is above that of morality, and that somehow sex is his game and, you know, women are his free playground because he's in the public eye. What's that thing, that awful thing that Trump says in that transcript, the pussy grabbing transcript? Because you're a star, he says.
Oh, I don't know that.
I think he says, because you're a star.
Well, I'm really interested in this, on the subject of Trump, because of this idea of fact and fiction as well, of post-truth politics and fake news, because I was most interested... Dolly said, watch this episode of Girls, we have to talk about it. And I would have watched it anyway, I hasten to add, because it is brilliant. But I was watching it thinking, okay, what's she wanting me to talk about? And the thing that I thought that she was so interested in is the idea of storytelling, because at the beginning there's this idea that Hannah has just assembled a tale out of these murky facts and she hasn't done her research, and actually it then becomes a very different type of storytelling. But culturally we are in this age of storytelling, the age of opinion, and who gives a toss about facts when you can base all your decisions on opinions? And I'm actually in the midst of writing a piece on my site about how fake news is, because I feel like we've read so much about fake news, but how fake news is affecting Generation Z, the generation below us. And I think it's because they are in this time where opinion is trumping facts. It feels really weird to keep using the word trumping, because obviously it's bloody Trump. And I realised this actually because a bunch of teenagers wrote quite a lot on my Instagram when I was in Colombia, and you can read more about it on the post I wrote on Colombia on my website. But they didn't like something, a fact that I had shared in my caption, and they kept on saying, you're a one-sided journalist. You know, you shouldn't write about stuff you don't know, which is the basic tenet of journalism, that you write about things you don't know. You learn about something.
Yes, you become a connoisseur on the job.
And then you write about it.
Yeah.
And they were saying, you know, you're one-sided. A fact is not one-sided. A fact is a fact. An opinion is one-sided. But what mesmerised and intrigued and worried me, all in equal measures, is that they did not realise the difference between opinion and fact. And I felt like at the beginning of this episode, there were lots of really interesting notes on fact and fiction and post-truth and storytelling and all those things now that have allowed people like Milo Yiannopoulos to become so incredibly popular, although thank God he now seems to be in his demise. But culturally there is this idea, I think, that we have a loose relationship in the truth, and the earliness of the episode really realised that, and then of course
I think it's still being examined, isn't it? It's a separate thing.
It's a totally separate thing to women and victimhood and sexual abuse.
Yes, but it's definitely something that's observed at the top. So the idea of female storytelling versus this grey area of sexual abuse.
And storytelling in general, mind, not even just female storytelling.
Yes, is seen in this girl's episode. It's also a very hot topic at the moment, thanks to Casey Affleck's win for Best Actor for his performance in Manchester by the Sea.
Have you seen
it? At the Oscars. Yeah, it's an astonishing film.
Yeah, I do really want to see it.
You must watch it.
I can't get anyone to come with me because obviously
I'll see it again with you.
Is it not quite suicidal?
Yeah, it's very sad.
Okay.
It stuck with me for days and days.
Okay.
And, you know, undoubtedly, he's astonishing. Mm. And I hate to say it, he is incredible. It was a sensitive, beautiful performance. And it was very, very moving. Well, it was intelligent. It was,
I mean, there have been GIFs and memes aplenty, as there always are about Oscar winners, to be fair. But Casey Affleck is obviously a particularly sensitive example, which we will get onto in a minute. But there, been all these GIFs suggesting that various Hollywood stars did not believe he was worthy of his Best Actor award. So there's Brie Larson not clapping, supposedly throwing shade. Denzel Washington biting his lip, supposedly throwing shade. Chrissy Teigen asleep tweeting, wait, what happened? I was asleep.
Dolly is throwing shade.
Dolly thinks she is throwing shade. I think she's genuinely asleep.
I've discovered this woman recently way too late, and I'm convinced we're meant to be best friends.
You're like mega basic as well, because loving Chrissy Teigen is like...
Is it basic?
Yeah, incredibly basic.
I'm just obsessed with her.
Yeah, they are like couple goals.
She's so funny.
Anyway, all this controversy is, of course, because of the murky stories that have emerged from Casey Affleck's personal life.
So the murky stories are... Casey Affleck directed a film called I'm Still Here, and two women who worked on that film filed separate sexual harassment allegations.
So that was a film in 2010. It was the sort of semi-autobiographical film with Joaquin Phoenix. So I haven't seen it, actually, but it is meant to be a very interesting film. So these two women
settled out of court. I didn't actually know this, and it was... I went to go see Manchester by the Sea and was not only completely... bowled over by Casey Affleck's performance. I thought he was one of the sexiest men I'd ever seen on screen.
I remember this. So your Twitter U-turn, as you call it.
My famous Twitter, one of my many Twitter U-turns. Sadly, there have been a few where I took to Twitter.
We've all read the zeitgeist wrong, Dolly.
Oh, God. I had to go to Twitter and went, oh, God, Casey Affleck. He's a bit of a fox, isn't he? Like, so basic.
Did you get loads of people being like...
Yeah, loads and loads Dolly, of tweets like, being like, this is really inappropriate. Like, educate yourself. And then I had to go, sorry, guys, didn't know. Take it back, he's not hot. Anyway, so he has been accused of not one but two charges, both settled out of court. It's not looking great. The question is whether you can separate the art from the artist. What do you think, Pandora? Do you think you can assess and publicly reward a person's talent separately to what they have done in their private life?
I'm trying to eat this lolly subtly.
It's not subtle.
Is it not? It's really hard to eat a
lolly. Sound like a bloody baby with a dummy next to me.
So I was having a Twitter chat with the brilliant film critic and culture writer Jonathan Dean. And he was saying that, you know, he genuinely, kind of like what you've said, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment on that, but he said genuinely he thought that, more wine, Dolly, genuinely he thought that Casey Affleck was the best male lead he had seen in years and years and years, and that no one came close.
Yeah, he was.
But that nobody was really interested in whether he was the best lead, because they were interested in the sort of disturbing sexual underpinnings. And it made me wonder, can you believe that someone is deserving, as in emotionally free, so post-truth free, emotionally free, unbiased, allocation of award based on talent and merit? Can you believe that someone can deserve an award if they are not of sound moral fibre? And of course, if this was the case in the film industry, then Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, Mel Gibson, amongst others, wouldn't be working anymore. But if we focus on the current situation, can you separate them?
No, I don't think you can. I don't think you can separate
them. So you would say that he's brilliant in Manchester on the Sea, but based on what you know of him, you don't think he deserves the accolade? Accolade.
No, I don't think it's appropriate for him to have been given an Oscar. I think it's really dangerous to elevate someone who's been accused of sexual harassment. I think it is very disrespectful to the victims, and I don't think talent should ever usurp morality.
Do you think it's a bit like the Chad Evans case?
Yeah, exactly. I know he was found guilty by a court, whereas Casey Affleck wasn't.
Well, it's difficult. What if it isn't true with Casey Affleck? Imagine, I know it's a slight chance, and I have to say, settling out of court for two different women does not bode well.
No, it's not great. And also, I think we're obviously in a time where the default is we believe those women that accuse, because it's so small the amount of people who accuse and it turn out to be fabricated. Mm. And I think, you know, this is well-trodden ground. Mm. I think... It's about the attitude, and the attitude, it's the same with Oscar Pistorius, it's the same with Brock Turner, it's the same with, I'm watching this O.J. Simpson documentary at the moment, which is 24 hours long. I'm going to be 30 by the time I finish it. But I spoke to my mum about the O.J. Simpson thing once, and I remember saying to her, like, I don't understand why it was such a thing and such a story, and she was like, oh, you don't get it. Everyone loved him. He was this American, you know, hero. And I was like, well, no, I don't really get that at all, because I don't really think... However good an actor someone is, however good at football they are, it doesn't make them exempt from the same fundamentals of morality as the rest of us.
And I'm interested in whether, I don't know enough about the O.J. Simpson one to know if race played into it, but what Jonathan Dean was saying is that he thought that regardless of all that Casey Affleck is accused of, the comparisons with Nate Parker, who is a black American director who was... disgraced. I mean, I don't think he managed. I think he literally, no one would work with him after accusations of sexual harassment. He might, to be fair, I haven't read enough on this. So from what I believe, he was found guilty and Casey Affleck obviously settled out of court. So
yeah, there was and that makes it different.
But and so the comparison is not valid. But a lot of people have suggested that Nate Parker was treated far, far more gravely than Casey Affleck has.
Which because, you think race came into place? Well, there, perhaps
people have suggested that race came into place, and also obviously that Casey Affleck is Ben friggin' Affleck's brother. Mm. On to the other Oscar chat, because there is a lot this year. Fertile ground. I'm finding all this La La Land backlash fucking tedious. People have gone from, I love it so much, it's so lovely and singy-songy and like uplifting and oh, it so sort of brings everything together in the world, to it's derivative and empty and hollow and why does it win anything and I hate the world.
Well, I am that arsehole, I'm afraid.
Okay, all right, come on then, arsehole.
Because I must say, I loved La La Land. I don't think it should have won any Oscars at all, because here's what I think
about
La La Land.
But can't you be grown up about it and accept that it has won the Oscars rather than shitting on poor Emma Stone?
No, because I really love Emma Stone, but I would be feeling pretty gutted if I were Natalie Portman and I lost out in that category. I loved La La Land. I found it charming and joyful and magical and exactly what we need and delightful. As a package, I adored it, but I don't think there was one element of it that was standalone enough to win an Oscar. I don't think the screenplay could have won an Oscar. It was plotless. I don't think the score was good enough. None of the songs were memorable. I don't think the direction was good enough, other than those three notes, which is how everyone comes back to me when I say that. I don't think the performance was strong enough. Ryan Gosling sang like Barney the dinosaur throughout the entire thing.
Yes, but Moulin Rouge. Singing in that's not great.
Yeah, for sure. They shouldn't have got Oscars. I don't think they did get Oscars.
Cool. We're going to go through the whole back catalogue now. Great. Courtesy of Dolly, arsehole all the time.
Emma Stone was charming in that film. And if there was an Oscar for the overall charm award, absolutely should have gone to La La Land and to me. But
I just feel really sad for them. I haven't seen Jackie and I do want to.
When you see it, you'll understand why I'm getting my knickers in a twist, because it was so...
I don't know why you've been finding all this time to go to the cinema, old girl.
Welcome to being a freelancer. Welcome to the dark side.
I haven't managed to find time to do that yet, but you're also incredibly busy. So well done for juggling your time.
You know what? Because I wasn't drinking in January, so I just constantly went to the cinema to stop myself from reaching for the bottle.
Yeah, to be fair, I have been visiting the bottle a fair amount. I haven't seen Jackie.
It's very powerful.
I know, I've heard Natalie Portman is amazing and her accent is amazing.
Yeah.
But it does just feel really uncouth to be trouncing her now she has won. But anyway, should we move on to the amazing gaff?
Oh yeah, I love this gaff. This is the gaff of a lifetime. We'll never see a gaff that bad again.
I wish I'd watched it live. I wish I'd been awake at 4 a.m. to watch it.
PwC accountants.
Right.
Oh, for God's sake.
Crunched through my lolly. I've broken the fourth wall of lollydom. So the gaff we are talking about is obviously... Oh, my God, you might have to talk about gaffs just while I swallow my lolly.
Pandora has decided to crunch
her lolly.
We've got
three lollies here. The new studios are
so she's,
awesome.
We're just very patiently. It's not like you're paying by the hour now. We'll just wait very patiently for Pandora to eat through her lolly. And then... when she decides ready enough to carry on with the podcast.
Or you can just allow me to be a little more mouthy than usual. That's pretty mouthy. So basically, the gaffe, obviously, is that Warren Beatty and... Who did he... I've had a mind
Faye
blank.
Faye Dunaway.
And Faye Dunaway were given the wrong envelope for best movie.
Yeah.
They were given one that said La La Land, but actually said Emma Stone La La Land.
It said best actress, yeah.
So it said best actress. So Warren Beatty kind of pauses and then just says... La La Land, and they get three speeches in until one of the producers of La La Land goes, guys, it's Moonlight. I'm sorry, we've got to give it to our friends at Moonlight. This is not
really
a joke. He's like, this is not a joke. And there are producers running across the background who actually apparently weren't producers. They were PwC accountants. So that's PricewaterhouseCooper.
I'm still confused about what the link is.
So PricewaterhouseCooper is a massive accounting firm. And they also deal with the balloting side of the Oscars. So, for example, there's a woman called Martha Ruiz, who is the co-head of the Oscars balloting team at PwC. And she is in charge of counting the votes of the 6,000 members of the Academy Award ballots. And in addition, she's also like the tax partner at PwC. But I suppose what they do is they're this massive global financing firm
accounting firm. Mm-hmm. So I imagine they have all sorts of rigors and procedures for counting 6,000 ballots.
I see.
The irony is that these rigors and procedures fully failed. But I was watching the two of the PwC accountants on this morning, and it was like they weren't accountants. It was like they wanted to become celebs. So they were being asked, you know, what was it like? You were obviously in the queue for the taxi rank. And one of them goes, not the taxi rank, the limo queue. So I think some of them were quite enjoying
really
the scandal.
Really found their moment, yeah.
Yeah. But obviously, there was a real... People were really up in arms because it did really ruin it for Moonlight winning that. I mean, Barry Jenkins was a bit like, thanks.
It was sad for everyone.
And also crap for... Crap for... Yeah. Crap for Warren Beatty.
Yeah, it was...
I felt really sorry
for poor old Warren Beatty, because he obviously, you can see, it was actually Faye Dunaway who read it. He opened it and he didn't want to read it aloud because he knew it was wrong. But everyone thought he was doing this sort of doddery old grandpa trying to make a crap joke by not saying it for suspense.
Like didn't Bruce Forsyth used to do that a lot?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Like obviously he didn't know what to say. So then Faye Dunaway just read it aloud. And then he had to explain afterwards that he wasn't joking and he just kind of sounded like Larry David.
And also I did quite enjoy though that he was one of the angriest. You know, they tried to... PricewaterhouseCoopers said, you know, can we take the envelope to investigate what's happening? He said, no one is getting this except Barry Jenkins from Moonlight, which seemed slightly...
Yeah, because he's old relevant. Hollywood. He understands this is a sacred thing.
But why does Barry need something that says Emma Stone, La La Land?
Oh, I don't
Surely
know.
You'd want the one that says Moonlight.
yeah.
But it was
particularly sad for Moonlight because it could have been such a history-making moment, particularly the subject of that film, you know, and now all we will remember, sadly, is the gaffe. That's all we remember
about
that moment.
But I love how the gaffe has, you know, obviously grown into this momentous thing, like everything Oscar related does. I also love that, like any year, the memes centre around Leonardo DiCaprio. Like, it doesn't matter what he's doing. And obviously, poor Leonardo DiCaprio, he's never won an Oscar. The memes are always going on about he hasn't won an Oscar. Now, apparently, he's somehow to blame for the wrong best film announcement. I don't know how we've got to that, but there's also all of these sort of counterclaims.
Because he's so bitter.
But I mean, it's not like he put Leonardo DiCaprio on the thing. But I would feel sorry for him if he did not have a never-ending supply of Victoria's Secret supermodels.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll find a bosom to cry into.
Anyway, we could talk about these gaffes
all day.
We could
talk about the gaffe all day. In fact, it is literally all me and my flatmate India talking about. She keeps sending me voice recordings of the man going, it's Moonlight, it's Moonlight.
I know, I want to read more on that, actually.
Right, we're going to move on. We're going to talk about workplace banter.
Is banter the worst word ever invented? It must be.
Vile. Awful.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about... So this is a story that has been in the news in the past week. And so a gay hedge fund manager... It is important that he's gay. I'm not just... That, you know, not just being really pedantic there. A gay hedge fund manager, Paul Newton, who is 43, he was dismissed after trading losses in the wake of Brexit. And he is suing his Citi firm for £1 million because he claims he was dismissed for homophobia and slurs about his sexuality. In his claim, he states that he was subjected to kind of persistent homophobia, with his colleagues calling him Pocahontas, princess, bitch, and other ones that I don't actually really want to read out. And also that his partner was referred to as a Brazilian rent boy. And he said his colleagues mimicked oral and anal sex when he was in the vicinity or talking to other people. He says, I'm a conservative guy. It was very upsetting to hear things. Now, this sounds really awful. His firm have said in response that Paul started inappropriate and crude conversations in the office and could not complain about the humiliating environment that he fostered. He has said that his language was used in a different context with no intent to offend. So I think this is really interesting because, I mean, all those slurs sound really homophobic. I agree. It's completely inappropriate. But I'm interested that the firm's response was, well, you created this environment. So
because you used the language in reference to yourself.
Because you used the language. And I think it's an interesting one about the ownership of language and who has the right to use.
It's interesting because a part of me, the majority of me, feels that the oppressed have had these horrific words and terms used against them for so many years. They should be allowed to use them however they want in reference to themselves. Or if that is a method of control or ownership or empowerment, and who the hell are we to tell them that we find it offensive?
And then on the flip side, what does your
minority
say?
But then on the flip side, I wish, I'm worried about saying this, but I just wish I didn't have to hear those words at all, you know, in the workplace or otherwise.
I don't think you should be worried about saying that.
Yes, I'd prefer to live in a world where I never hear those words, but perhaps that's a very privileged positioning because those words have never been used against me.
But I don't think you're coming from a personal bias in this. I think you are right to say it in the specific context of confusion. I think it fosters confusion.
I understand that while we're still in a time of such prevalent prejudice, it's pie in the sky for me to say I would prefer a world where we just don't say them. It's so much more complicated, I think.
Of course it's more complicated than that. But I also think because we are in, as you say, this time of privilege, and basically I think we need to make things as simple as possible for people to behave well. I really do. I think it has to be really straightforward of what is okay and what is not okay until people properly understand. And I don't think you help yourself by perpetuating words that can so easily be misinterpreted and turned into hurtful weapons. You know, I was at a Drake concert recently, and this isn't about sexually charged terms, but racially charged ones. And every third word was the N-word or calling out bitches. And everyone in my box was singing along and dancing. And I thought, I can't sing along and dance. That's not my word to take ownership of. It's completely inappropriate, I felt, for me as a white woman to be singing the N-word. And that was an environment where I thought, hold on, if I'm confused and I feel complicated by this, as a journalist who works in the media and I'm around language all the time, we talk about language constantly and we understand the potency of language, then it felt like an incredibly tremulous line to be treading. And I think that we can only really come to a point where people aren't putting their feet in it the whole time if we remove that flammable rhetoric. So yes, of course, there's an element of taking ownership and of turning that word into something powerful rather than demeaning, but I also think it just leads us further and further away from an environment.
Well, basically what you're saying is, which I think I agree with, is that sadly we live in a world of people that are like quite stupid or unenlightened, and it's too complicated for them to grasp that, so it will always be used incorrectly.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to think twice before I say certain stuff, like, you know, calling a boy wet or, oh, you big girl's blouse.
Also, Drake should not be calling women bitches anyway.
Because it's not his word to take. But no. Also, or another one that I find myself sometimes doing is, oh my God, I look insane. Obviously, that's
inappropriate. Yeah, lame. I got called out about
lames,
that.
Or you know, when children go, my God, that's so gay. I mean, there is so much that we could all learn.
And we need to get into the habit. I agree with you on that. We all need to be practicing.
Yeah, I catch myself.
Like, because also it's only being on eggshells for a bit. And then when it becomes habit, it's not being on eggshells anymore.
I think it would be a great start if there was an absence of all these derogatory words, regardless of context and intent. Because saying, oh, I meant that when I said that, but he didn't mean that because he's not experienced that, it gets confusing. You know, when you have the words on a page and a story regaled through second, third, and even fourth parties, the context and the intent, all you're left with is the bold, bad words. Should we have some high-low questions? Should we finish off with our segment, Ask the High-Low?
So we used to do this with
Pandoli.
Thank you so much, and by the way, and please do email us. They can be long or short, dilemmas, silly, whatever.
TheHighLowShow@gmail.com or @TheHighLowShow on Twitter.
Okay, email number one. First off, me and my friend want to say we love Pandoli and we can't wait for the high-low. You gave us something to look forward to every week.
Thanks.
Thank you, darling. Secondly, we'd like to remain anonymous in this question. So our current dilemma is that we are two straight women living with two boys who we have developed feelings for. Weird, right? Yeah, you're not living in friends. They are leaving in a few months and we are contemplating acting on those feelings at some point. However, from living together, we have found out that they have some issues and/or lack a full understanding of feminism and other issues of social justice, such as systemic racism, which are very important to us. Is it worth digging deeper and seeing if they will be more understanding? They are generally very kind, or just forgetting about it all entirely? Is romance with a roommate just absolutely stupid to begin with?
Well, I think there's two different points. Romance with a roommate,
I think, is mad. Yeah, I think it's a really stupid
idea. I don't think it's a great idea. But as for, I love that it's so, I just think it's really lovely that you're like, you know, can I commit to this person when I don't think they're as kind of politically aware as I am? Yes, absolutely. I think you learn. We all learn. I'm learning every day. Teach him. I do love that these are two separate men who seem to have exactly the same issues. But all I can say to you, two separate women, and you're two separate men, and
both scenarios might not be identical, is he open to learning? Is he interested in your opinion? If so, yes. If not, he's just quite lols and lives in the next door room. Avoid.
I completely agree with Pandora. I think give him a chance. Obviously, it's not your job to be educating this man, but it is your responsibility as a liberal-minded person to be opening up a conversation and listening to their side and trying to help them understand your way of seeing. And then hopefully they'll realise they're being idiots.
But also you don't have to share exactly the same views.
You don't have to share the same views, but if he's racism,
was there racism?
Yeah,
there?
Racism and misogyny is sort of a deal breaker, I think, in love.
I thought it was about learning about feminism. I have to say that I have a lot of friends who still need to learn about, you know, all the tenets of feminism.
Yeah.
We've got another question from Dolly's dad saying, wishing you much success on your venture. Love, Dolly's dad.
Really not a question,
which
Dad.
Is, yeah,
thanks
that's
for
not a
emailing.
Question. And we have another hilarious one from the writer Daisy Buchanan saying that she wants to declare her massive fandom already of The Hilo Show before we've launched. And this isn't a question, but I think that every week you should challenge us yourselves to do something high and low at the same time, e.g. eating a pack of Dutchie Original quail eggs whilst wearing an old school Levi's hoodie and no pants.
Which I'm also doing right now.
Also, what does the Hilo smell like? Would you consider releasing a fragrance? No. And you could wear high and low separately or layer them for the full experience. Daisy, I wonder if you're high whilst writing this.
I love this. Daisy, let's talk. I know that you're passionate about perfume. Let's make it happen.
Passionate about perfume?
She loves perfume.
No, I know, it's just the way you said, I know you're passionate about perfume. Thank God you don't work in advertising.
I have a question. I'm in my early 20s and I know 100% that I want to have children one day, but I also love, love, love my career and my great single life, and I don't see things changing for quite a while. Read at least 10 more years of hashtag girlboss fun. But the women in my family have a history of early menopause in their late 30s, and I know that I'm at my reproductive peak right now. Is it too soon to look into freezing my eggs? My friends seem to think it's a bit weirdly keen to want to do this now, and it's a really expensive procedure with lots and lots of hassle. You have to have scans and appointments and things every day for a month or something. But I also really know that I was born to have a family, and the best chance of that happening is if I freeze my eggs.
What does she do?
I think she does it. I really think that you should, if this is something you know you want, I think it is like a feminist act. This is a brilliant thing. You want children. It's nothing to do with wanting to meet a man. You want to bank that for yourself so you don't have to make a bad decision and be at the mercy of a man's choice over you.
It annoys me that your friends are saying it's weirdly keen. It's not like
it's
you're
not
going
keen.
Into the street, jumping someone and saying, I want to have children right now. You know, you're thinking ahead because you have a very real biological fact in your family, which is that they all suffer from very early menopause.
And also, it doesn't make you, we've got to stop this thing that it makes a woman some sort of psycho for deciding that at some point in the future she wants children. That's a completely natural desire. And if you want to take matters into your own hands, it's your body.
She does.
Fucking go for
it. She raises this really interesting point. It says, why do we not discuss fertility more as a society? And I completely agree. I'd like to think that's the next step of, you know how it feels like every year there's like a thing?
Hopefully
maybe the
it
next
will become
thing
a more open discussion.
Might be fertility.
I say go for it, and
yeah,
I think that you're being really responsible.
Absolutely, so do I. Don't let anyone tell you you're weird. Just say,
no.
Just say, okay, all right.
No, it's none of their business.
Just say to them, okay, well, in 15 years, when you guys are having children and I'm possibly having the menopause, tell me then if you think I'm weird
exactly.
for not freezing my eggs.
Exactly.
And you may, incidentally, can I just say, being single and having hashtag girlboss fun, please do that. You're in your early 20s. But also, don't feel like you can't settle down, have children, and have girlboss fun.
I'm sitting opposite the biggest girlboss I know, and she's Mrs. Married.
I have lots of friends with babies who are still having hashtag girl boss fun. I really need to stop saying that. It's kind of awful how many times I've said it. So don't feel like your life is over. Episode one done of The Hilo. Thank you to everyone who sent us questions. Please, as we say, tweet us, email us. Thank you very much to SNK Studios for hosting us for our first podcast. Thank you to Lauren Benstead for the jingle. Everyone who helped us with the artwork, Eva Salvi, Fash Gif, Natalia Bagnishka.
Thank you to our lovely loyal listeners. We've really appreciated your support.
Thank you to our producer, Charlie.
I mean, we think we are in the Oscars now.
I think we think we've done an Oscars.
Yes. Let's wrap it up.
And we will see you next week. Just please do note that I am going to Jamaica for a wedding. So next week's episode two, will be coming to you on Friday. I am literally coming straight from the airport to record a podcast with Dolly.
And do you know why? Because you're a girl boss.
Because I'm a girl boss. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.